Let us all bring our palms together in veneration of the greatest teacher we have all ever seen, our master, our guide, the supremely enlightened one, the fully awakened one, the omniscient one, the perfect one, he whose magnificence is limitless, he whose compassion is boundless. Our light in the darkness. It is to his name we make this veneration, and as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is an opportunity that we have to renew our oath of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem, which is also synonymous with ultimate bliss.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Do we have any first timers here today? Welcome. Last timers? People, the rest of you are in between. Okay. When is your last time there? Yeah, well, after you become an arahant, there's no reason for you to come to these talks. After that, you should go doing these talks. And I will be in the audience. And you can come and sit here. So what's happening with that little monastery in your hearts that I wanted you all to start building? Have you started putting the foundations yet? Or are you still doing the excavation work? What's the deal? What's the situation? What's the status? Start a work on the monastery? Is it expanding? Have you got the blueprint ready? What does it look like? Is there room for one? And just one? No more? How many can you fit in there? Only you know the answer to that. How many can you fit in your monastery? Think of the Buddha for a second. See, before his time, there were no monasteries. Were there? There were no monasteries before then. You know in what sense I mean this. Because of course there were lots of monasteries. But there were no monasteries in the sense that I intend. So he constructed the very first monastery. That is a monastery of loving kindness, but untainted loving kindness, which is based in unconditional love. There was no such monastery before his time. That monastery has or had its foundations based in loving kindness, compassion, equanimity and mercifulness. You may have heard these terms as metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. The walls went up and this was to be the land of the Buddha, this monastery. Not this monastery, the monastery that I refer to. That was the land of the Buddha. So on these four, after he laid down the foundations, then he started to build the four walls, and they were going to be the Satipatthana. Kayanupassana, Vedananupassana, Chittanupassana and Dhammanupassana. So he built these walls, brick by brick. They went up. on the foundations of metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. It wouldn't work any other way. So you've got to look at that blueprint and then build your own monastery. As the Buddha always said, I can only show you the path, but I can't walk this path for you, right? So in other words, what he's saying is, I can show you how to build a monastery. You're going to have to build your own. And how many you fit into it all depends on your capacity. But as you keep progressing in the Dhamma, this is your own reflection. You need to know these, the answers to these questions. How many can you fit into your monastery? It all depends on how strong your foundations are. If you have a strong foundation, if the walls can rise up to the sky, then you can fit as many as well, as many as possible, and as many as would like to come and take shelter in that monastery. In the Buddha's monastery, the one that he built 2,500 years ago, as a bodhisattva he started building that. And then when it came time for him to achieve ultimate wisdom, become the fully awakened one, that's when the last piece, perhaps the roof tile, went on top, and then the whole construction was complete. And then by that time, it was so massive, so big, that he himself walked out and looked at it, and he was amazed at the marvel that he had built. 7 whole weeks he spent just reflecting upon the grandeur of the monastery that he had built. And boy, oh boy, was that one monastery. And to this day, we still take shelter. No matter how many walk in there, there's still room for more. This is the monastery that we have all taken shelter in. Remember, it was built on the foundations of metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. It wouldn't work any other way. A lot of the time I see people very, very concerned and very focused on some of the more profound, some of the very deep concepts of the Dhamma, such as the four walls. How can we start building the walls? How can we start working on Kaya Anupassana when they haven't yet laid down the foundations of Metta? Take a moment to think about what I mean and what I intend to say here. Far too often you see people like that. They're more concerned about how we can build the wall of Citta Anupassana when they haven't even started laying down the foundation of Karuna. They don't know what it means to be compassionate yet, but they're already far too busy trying to put up the walls of Dhamma Anupassana. It's funny. It really is funny when people try and do that. You try and convince them. You try and speak sense into their heads, but will they listen? How can they listen? Because they don't have the foundations to listen. Even to listen to what someone has to say, you need to have the basic foundations. You need to have a sense of compassion. You need to have a sense of equanimity. You need to be able to accept what other people have to say and not always think that I'm the one who's always right. Don't you see, often, don't you come across people in society where you know they are doing absolutely the wrong thing, and you try and convince them, you try and tell them, you try and teach them what they need to be doing, but will they listen? No. You try again, will they listen? No. You try again, and then there comes a point where you realize, this idiot is not going to listen to what I'm going to say, so let him learn it the hard way. Have you not had this experience in life? Sometimes I find myself in a position where I kind of get this experience. I'm getting it a lot more than I used to. It's very difficult to teach a man something he already knows, isn't it? Don't you think so? Now, most of you, if not all of you, are students. That's why I like to talk to this audience. Most of you, if not all of you, are students. You have a teacher. It is such a privilege and an honor to have a teacher. And one must recognize that it is merits that you trade to have a teacher. You don't get a teacher for free. You think I got mine for free? Oh, where do we start? You don't get a teacher for free. You have to trade. You have to trade hard-earned merits for that. Some people have the merits to have a teacher, but what they don't have the merits is, or at least, I don't know whether it's merits or what it is, maybe it's the attitude. Some people just don't have the attitude to make use of a teacher in an appropriate manner, in a way that is beneficial to them. The reason for this is this. They're far too concerned about putting up those walls, when really their prime focus should be on laying down the foundations. So they walk up to their teacher and say, I know these things, what can you teach me? I already know this, that and the other. I know Kaya Anupassana, I'm here to learn Dhamma Anupassana. Come on. If one knows Kaya Anupassana, you don't need to teach him Dhamma Anupassana. But that's what they don't get that. I already know Kaya Anupassana, teach me Dhamma Anupassana. So what am I here to learn? Dhamma Anupassana. I already know Dhamma Anupassana. Can you teach me Chitta Anupassana? See, what this person doesn't understand is, if one knows Kaya Anupassana, they also know Chitta Anupassana, they also know Dhamma Anupassana, and they also know Vedana Anupassana. Because the principles are the same. It's like, if you know white, don't you know black? If someone walked up to you and said, I know white, can you teach me black, please? It makes no sense. Then they don't know white either. But the problem is, they have the merits to have the presence of a teacher, but what they don't have is the attitude to learn from one. And oftentimes it's because they walk up to their teachers and they have this aura of, I know it all about them. And then it becomes incredibly difficult for the teacher to show them compassion, because compassion is something that, when given, they have to be receptive to. I mean, don't you think the Buddha always had compassion? The Buddha is compassion, isn't it? It's a bit of a silly question. Did the Buddha have compassion? I mean, it's like saying, does compassion have compassion? The Buddha is compassion. Did he only have it sometimes? When he was in front of people he liked? Oh, and you know, when people came up to him and he didn't like them very much, didn't have a lot of compassion towards them, do you think that was what the Buddha was? No, he had compassion, and actually that's wrong to say he had compassion. He was compassion. He was compassion on two legs. That's what he was. Right? So compassion was always there, but people like Chundasukara could not benefit from that. Even people like Potali, I mean, they were saved by the skin of their teeth, but that was just sheer luck. Devadatta, how much compassion do you think the Buddha would have exerted and shown him? But he just didn't have the attitude. I don't think Devadatta did not have the merits. He had merits to be of the same bloodline as the Buddha. Related. I mean, how much closer can you get to a Buddha, besides maybe being his own son? How much closer can you get? In that sense, how far are we to the Buddha? But yet, don't you feel close to him? So just imagine. An abundance of merits, that's what Devadatta was. But if he had the right attitude, he would have gone on to become a great, great man. But what a pity. See, that goes to prove something, doesn't it? Now you see, on a day like today, we are all here for Dakkineyo. And then in a couple of weeks' time, we have Vesak coming along. And we have these occasions at the monastery, these are opportunities for us to earn lots and lots and lots of merits. You have lots of merits, and that is why you are here. In fact, you go beyond that because, like I said, pretty much each and every one of you, you have a personal teacher at this monastery. If you have a prayer mat on your shoulder, then you have a teacher. Because what is a prayer mat for, after all? To get down on your knees. Where? At the feet of your teacher. The teacher represents the teaching. Because if you look at your teacher will also have a prayer mat on his shoulder. And then his teacher will also have a prayer mat on his shoulder. And then keep going on and on and on and on and on. You don't see the prayer mat there, but there is one. His teacher was the teaching. The Dhamma is my teacher, as the Buddha would say. I'm often weary of finding anyone. I mean, whenever someone comes and asks, who should I find, who should I have as a teacher? I always say, always find a teacher who has a teacher. It's the same thing that I just mentioned a moment ago. Always find the teacher who has a teacher. Because if you come across someone who doesn't have a teacher, what that says is they haven't laid down the foundations yet. So their walls are not going to be built up on metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. So these walls, as they start building them up, they're not going to stand the test of time. They're not going to stand the elements. The slightest thing can knock it down. And so really, that would not be kaya anupassana anyway. Because kaya anupassana is not something, once you build, it's going to fall. It's going to topple over. It doesn't work like that. Because once it's built, once wisdom has been acquired, it has been acquired. It does not have to be maintained. That's the uniqueness of the sasana. All other things, including going to the heavens and going to the hells, you're there temporarily. You don't get a permanent visa to the Paranimitta Vasavarti. You don't even get a permanent visa to the Aviti. They don't give you citizenship there. After a while, they kick you out. But when Nibbana is concerned, there, you get permanent residency. Once you acquire a certain level of wisdom, and if it is unconditional, unlike the learnings that we take on, right? Things we learn every day, things we learn at school, things we learn at uni, things we learn at work, things we learn about how to live life. Unlike these things, ladies and gentlemen, which you tend to forget, and death is the inevitable, which makes you forget everything you've learned. Unlike that, the wisdom that you acquire on the path, by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, it doesn't leave you. You may forget the words, you may forget the terms of reference, but the wisdom that you have acquired, it doesn't leave you, it's there for, with you till the rest of your journey to the end of samsara. Now, what happens if you find a teacher who does not have a teacher? You have to be wary of that. Because their walls will not be built on good foundations. So therefore, any instruction and advice they give you, you will have to take with a lot of caution. Now the same would apply to you as well. You all have a lot of merits, all of us. We all have a lot of merits. What we need to make sure is that we have the right attitude on our journey to Nibbana. Because, as I said, if in the presence of a teacher, if in the presence of someone who is willing to show you compassion, like the Buddha did to Devadatta, Thero, who had an abundance of merits but just didn't have the right attitude, if you face such a situation, then unfortunately the Buddha's compassion can do nothing for you. And so, the same goes for your teachers. Now, as you build this monastery up within yourselves, I need you to make sure that you're laying down a very good and solid foundation. This foundation must be built on the four pillars of metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. So you might have this question, what do you mean by metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha? It's like asking, what do you mean by the Indian Ocean? Can you explain that to us? These are qualities that are limitless, boundless, infinite. Like I said, the Buddha is synonymous with compassion. So in just the same way that if you ask me to describe the Buddha, I have no words and words will fail me every single time. If you ask me to explain compassion and describe compassion to you, then my words will always fail me. So then how can you do something when words fail you? I mean, that seems like a... a chicken out close. Right? So I don't know what compassion is, so how can I be compassionate? You will feel what compassion is. It's your approach, it's your attitude to yourself and all others around you. It's difficult to explain to you what compassion is. It's difficult to explain to you exactly what loving kindness is, or what mercifulness is, or what equanimity is. But as you progress in the Dhamma, these four foundations will start to be laid down, and do it to whatever extent you can right now. Whatever way in which you understand it. Now, I think we all have enough sense about us to understand that our actions can cause harm to others and it can cause good to others, right? So if you have a basic understanding of what actions, what behavior is hurtful to others and what behavior is good to others, if you have that basic understanding, that's good enough to start laying down the foundations. Now, is there anyone in this room who doesn't know whether killing is good or bad for others? Anyone in this room? There you go. Anyone in this room who is not sure whether stealing, taking something that belongs to someone without their permission, is good or bad? Not sure, Swami, no answer. If you have ever felt like nicking something that belongs to someone, like did you have to toss a coin to see whether it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? No, you never did, because conscience is a good compass. Your conscience will always guide you. You know, you are in the Sugati world. Therefore, you have this rhythm about you. It's there, it's inbuilt. You come with that. It's part of the karma that you've done to be born human. That moral compass, it's there. If you were born an animal, you don't have that. If you were born in the Dugati world, you don't have that moral compass. But you as human beings, you have that moral compass. Even murderers, they have it. Thieves, they have it. They all have it. A suicide bomber, they have it. They have a moral compass. They know what right is right and wrong is wrong. They know good from bad. They may not understand anicca, dukkha, and anatta. They may not understand how to go beyond good to greatness. That they may not understand. But when you are born a human being, you get to experience a mother's love. You get to experience a father's love. And that gives you the basic background to understand what goodness is all about. As you grow up in that sort of environment, you see how your parents treat you. You see people showing you love and affection. Hardly anyone has never seen love and affection in their lives. Right? There are people who are a little less fortunate than others, maybe more or less fortunate than others, but I can't think of any man or woman who's never experienced love or affection from someone. Well, they must have lived in a cave somewhere and never had any interaction. Even still, they have something towards themselves. They feel a sense of protection. They feel a sense of responsibility towards themselves. Even still. But 9 times out of 10, people have experienced love, affection, kindness and gentleness. So you can start there. We can all start there. I think to this audience, it's a huge... I mean, I'm undermining you by saying you can start there because you're way past that. That I understand. But what I want you all to make sure is that when you start building these four walls, that you're going to call the kingdom or the palace of Nibbana, before you start laying down bricks, before you start laying down the rafters, before you start laying down the ceiling, before you start putting up the roof, and finally before you start putting down the roof tiles right at the top, at the pinnacle, it's important that you make sure that your foundations are based in metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. It's very important. And to what extent? To whatever extent you can understand it. It's so important, ladies and gentlemen, that on this path to Nibbana, we examine every action that we take. Nibbana is not something you would do on a Saturday morning. It's not something that you do on Sundays. You know, going to church may be something you can do on a Sunday. Going to the mosque may be something you can do on a Friday. People think going to Nibbana is something you do on a Poya day. It's not. It doesn't work like that. Because Nibbana is all about your attitude. Even if you had the merits, without the right attitude, you can't reap the fruit of Nibbana. So this is why I say, even when you're in the presence of a teacher, which all of us are privileged to be, we have the presence of a teacher, we have someone who takes responsibility to guide us. They can't take responsibility for our Nibbana, can they? No one can do that. But they can take responsibility of guiding us. It's important that when we are in their presence, we are there with the right attitude. So as you start building this monastery within yourselves, the monastery of Nibbana, that you build in your heart, make sure that you lay down the right foundation. Examine your every action. Examine your every thought. It's difficult, I know. All of what I'm sharing with you here, it's going to be easier said than done. But if there's no alternative to doing it, then what can I do? I can only sympathize with you. It's easier said than done. I'm sorry. What can I do? It has to be done anyway. It has to be done. There's no alternative. So examine every action that you take. I mean, this is Nibbana. To examine every action that you take. Examine every word that comes through your lips. Examine it. Even if it happens after the fact, reflect on that and ask yourself, was that a word that I should have said? Or was that a word that I should have restrained? Examine. Isn't this why we have come into the sasana? You know, the other day I was thinking to myself, people come into the sasana for all sorts of reasons. Why have you come into the sasana? Ask yourself that question for a second. Why have you come into the sasana? I can ask you this question because pretty much every one of you have come into the sasana in whatever capacity you can. Are you devotees or the devoted? Which one are you? Devoted. Okay. So I'm talking to the devoted. This is a good opportunity for the devotees, if there are any among you. Because if I speak to the devotees, you never get to hear some of these things. These are talks of the devoted. The very fortunate among our devotees also come along. Why do people come into the sasana? There are many reasons why people come into the sasana. I will share with you some that come to my mind. You ask yourself if this is why you have come into this asana. Okay? Number one. They're old and now they're worthless to the rest of society. So you need something to give you protection. Sort of like seeking asylum. You need someone to look after you now that you're old. Your children don't care much about you anymore. Your grandchildren, least of all, they're far too busy. They're busy building up their own lives. But your plan was that when you were old, your children would look after you, but seems like that's not on their agenda. So now something has to happen, someone has to happen. There's not a lot left in the coffers. You've given it all up to your children. You spent all that money building up property for them and buying property for them, and you spent the remainder of your fortune on getting them married off to a good girl, right, or a good boy. Now that good girl and good boy, they've left you. not so good anymore. And now you're alone. So now you're old, and as you keep going older and older, it's going to become very difficult to look after yourself. You need help now going to the toilet. You need help turning around in bed, otherwise you're going to start getting bed sores. You need someone to bring your food to you and feed you. Right? So, it's difficult. Life is getting difficult. Right? You do sometimes wonder, you look at a rope and you think, maybe this is going to be my friend. But then you realize, no, I can't do that. That's not good. That's bad. Right? Maybe I can go to the sasana for help. Because you do fear. I mean, you do fear putting that noose around your neck and hanging yourself, because you've heard of the stories. What happened to people? Right? If they go and off with themselves, what happens to them? So you've heard all this stuff. So it seems that, you know, until death will come and knock on my door, I have to be there somewhere that someone's going to look after me. Let me go to the sasana. This is one kind of person. So I'm just telling you the kind of people that come into the sasana. You ask yourself if this is you. I'm not here to say which any of these is right or wrong. Who am I to decide that? I mean, the Buddha created the sasana for everyone, right? So if there are those who wish to come to the sasana seeking refuge in their old age, then so be it. That's one kind. Now, if that is you though, here are some of the things you have to do. Make sure that you find a kuti that is close to maybe a hospital or something. Right? Find a monastery that is maybe, or a temple that is close to a hospital, some kind of medical facility, so that in the case of emergencies they can give you that medical aid. Look for somewhere where they have more youngish people than oldish people, because you need someone to come and change your nappies. Because if everyone else is also your age, then it's going to be a bit difficult. So, you've got to be mindful about these things, if that is why you have come into this asana. I know you're looking at me like, Swami Mahansa, how can you talk to us like that? I'm not for the slightest suggesting that this is you. I'm just saying these are some of the kind of people that come into the sasana. Am I wrong? Put your hand up and say, Swami Nasa, you are wrong. People don't come like that to the sasana. Oh. When you've been in the sasana for this long, not very long, but even this long, you come across various characters. This is one of the reasons people come into the sasana. Then there's another type. This other type, people come into the sasana because they want recognition. All their lives they wanted someone to show them respect, show them reverence, give them praise and honor, and show them dignity. But unfortunately, they've not got that. Wherever they went, you know, people just mocked them, laughed at them, talked them down. They never showed them respect, regard, or held them in high esteem. They never earned, you know, just even, they never got themselves a salute, or even those sweet words, good morning, sir. I never got that. Good morning, madam. Never got that. They tried to get to a position in society, maybe a profession or a career, in which they would have subordinates, or even as a teacher, maybe have students who might show them respect, but none of that worked out either. So they were a failure in that regard. And now, it's beginning to sting them. It's beginning to hurt. Right? So life is ticking on. Now they're sort of in the midlife crisis. It's getting to that point where it's now or never. Either someone starts showing me respect now, or it's going to be too late. So then they wonder, if at this point I can't get somewhere in society that's of reasonable standing in reasonable status or position in society where I can have and receive praise, honor, glory, respect and all these things, then it's now or never, so I had better do something about it. So then they look around and they see people who come from all walks of life. Whether you're a king or a beggar, once you come into the sasana, once you get that robe on, then people get down on their knees in front of you and they worship you. And they come to you seeking refuge. They put their forehead on your feet and they worship you. They stand up when you walk in. Am I talking to the right audience? Yeah. Okay. Like I said, I don't know how much of this you can put online, but this is the Saturday sermon. Because you're all now in the sasana. I'm just saying these are some of the reasons why people come into the sasana. Why am I saying this? I don't know, I'm just saying it. Why not, right? It's a Saturday morning, something has to be said, so I'm saying it. You can examine yourselves. Why have you come to the sasana? It's good to ask yourself that question from time to time. Why have I come to the sasana? And then there's a question you have to ask yourself right at the end. How to figure out why you have come to the sasana. We'll come to that later. So glory is what you wanted. Fame is what you wanted. Honor was what you wanted. Respect was what you wanted. Obedience was what you wanted. A staff was what you wanted. People to show you and hold you in high esteem was what you wanted. But unfortunately, you didn't get any of that. So it seemed like the sasana was the best place for that because everyone worships you now. They come and offer you things and then they worship you and for taking it. I mean, normally when you give something to someone, you expect them to say what? You expect them to say thank you, right? But the sasana is a different thing. In the sasana, you expect, you give something for it and say, thank you for letting me offer this to you. Adivase tuno bante means, venerable sir, please permit me and excuse me. Please accept my offering. Have mercy towards me and please accept my offering. That is what those words mean. As you make an offering, you request for their mercy to give you, for giving you the opportunity, to give you the opportunity to make that offering. It's a very different thing, the sasana. And that is right. It is right. Like I said, you know, I have not made this monastery, the monastery has made me. I don't make the sasana makes me. My mother never gave me to the sasana, my mother gave the sasana to me. This is a gift. It's the way it works. You know, if you ever make a donation to the sasana, make two of it, because one is the donation that you want to make and the second one is for the opportunity to make that offering. Because in the sasana, this is a bank where your return is infinite. Whenever you make an investment, the return is infinite. So it's a very unique thing. So people do come into the sasana for that. They come for respect, they come for honor. That's the second kind of people. And how do you know if that is you? If that is you, then things like this are very important to you. Like, what is your rank in the Sangha Mahalu order? In the order of seniority, what is your rank? These things are very important. Because the further up you are, the more people salute you. It's nice, isn't it? Whether you have a title. So you're not just the most venerable, but you're the most venerable, and then after your name comes a lot of other things. I'm not saying they're all like that. Sometimes that is what, these are responsibilities that they have to bear. But what I'm saying is, there are some who come to the sasana for that. Because in society, that was not possible. Because, you know, the Buddha, when he created the sasana, he created this seniority in the sasana. And that was for the longevity of the sasana, he had to do that. So if you come in early, it's first come, not first served, but rather first come, you are senior in the sasana. That's the way it was meant to work. But in society, they'd normally check your qualifications. Yeah, they interview you. They find out what you're capable of, what your strengths are, weaknesses are. Then they give you a test. But in the sasana, not so much. I mean, hardly at all, really. Perhaps, you know, when you go really up in rank, maybe so. But generally speaking, if you've come in early, then you get the first seat. That's the way it works. Now, this applies even to the Sila Shravikas, Anagarikas, Anagarikas, Swami Mahan says to all of you. So your position in your community would have been determined by when you came in. So if this is what you have come in for the sasana, it's very important that you come in early. The early worm or the early bird gets the worm. So you must be the early bird if you want the worm. It's a worm you get. That's another reason why people come into the sasana. Then there's another reason why people come to the sasana. They come into the sasana to chill. Chill. To relax. Life has taken a toll on them. They've been working their whole life, right, 9 to 5, from whenever they can remember. Soon after school, you went to university, and then after that you took a job, and then after that you got married, after that you had kids, and you started to build, you bought property, you've been working since, right, day and night, non-stop, now your children to feed, bills to pay, right, it's been hectic, one hectic life. One day after the other, it's just been a relentless chore of a life. And that's been going on for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and now life has just completely exhausted you. So now you're just too tired. Now you need to relax. So some people come into the sasana, and what they're doing is relaxing. In fact, you know, you could sweep the whole of Punjab and you won't find a more relaxing thing than people who come to the sasana and relaxing. They are so relaxing. Because that is why they have come to the sasana. They want to relax. I'm not the only one who has come to the sasana. Mind you have all come to the sasana. Okay? So this is not, I'm not just talking about monks here. I'm talking about each and every one of you, because this is a talk that I'm giving to monks, Anagarikas, Anagarikas, Sila Shravakas, Shravakas, and Uesis, and some of our most fortunate devotees. This is one reason why people come into the sasana, so they can relax. It's the latter part of their lives. And if you are out there, you have to do a lot. Because it's a dog-eat-dog world. You have to constantly exert labor. But whereas if you come into the sasana, devotees feed you. They give you shelter. They give you your meals. And when you're ill, they treat you, they give you medicines. And for as long as you are there, you are counted as a number, and food is cooked for you, a place is built for you, you have a bed that is given to you, you have robes that are given to you, or you know, whatever attire that you are clad in. So things come to you very freely. What you don't recognize is that you're paying this off with your merits, but that's easy to ignore because you don't see that. Yeah? You don't see that. It's like day turning into night. You don't see it happening, but it happens. It's only after it has happened you know, oh, where's the daylight gone? It's dark already. Huh. But you don't see day turning into night because it happens so slowly. Your expending of merits is the same. It happens nonetheless, but you don't see it happening. So some people, they come into the sasana to relax. So these are people who, now this is you. I know this is not you, but I'm just saying, if this is you, these are the kind of attitudes that you might have. Why should I go and sweep the Dhamma hall? Someone else can do that. Why should I go and fill the water jug? Someone else can do that. Why should I go and sweep the hall? Or why should I go and fill the water? Why should I go and cook the food? Someone else can do that. The devotees are here to do all this for me. It's easy now, right? I don't have to earn a living. Now the devotees will look after me. So why should I? They are here to relax. There is still energy left within them. Lots of it. But they don't feel like it is their time to contribute. They feel like it's now their time to deserve. And so they expect a lot and they give very little. As far as the sasana is concerned, that's just a dead weight. You know, it's a weight that you bump into it, so you have to pick it up and leave it somewhere and then walk. And then when the next one comes in, it's another weight. So you pick it up and put it somewhere else and walk. You just can't throw the damn thing. It has to be there. As far as the sasana is concerned, that's what that is. But there are people who come into the sasana because they feel it's time to relax. There are some people like that. That's not you, is it? No. And then they expect everything has to be done for them. If they need some water, it has to be brought to them. If they need some food, it has to be cooked for them. If they need to go somewhere, they have to be taken there. You know, what Guruhandra always tells us, never expect a single thing from our devotees. If they wish to do it, that is their own choosing. They may do it for their own salvation, they will do it for their own merits. It is not for you to expect. Because a Sramana never expects. How can you expect and give up at the same time? Those two things, they don't make, you know, they are mutually exclusive, aren't they? I'm here to give everything up, but I expect. What? But there are those like that, who come into the sasana, they come here to relax. Then, there's another kind of group. They come into the sasana to enjoy, have fun. They come to have a good laugh. So they come into the sasana expecting a lot of comforts, expecting comforts and pleasures that they never had sometimes in their lay lives. Typically that is the case. In their lay lives they never had it. Because a lot of the time if you've already experienced, I don't know if enjoy is the right word, if you've already experienced a lot of those things, you know, you've already had it, you know that there is no pleasure to be had in them, there's no satisfaction to be gained from them. So you come into the sasana looking for something more than that. You know, that is what I believe someone should come into the sasana for. See, they should come into the sasana expecting to achieve a happiness that the most expensive car cannot give. They should come into the sasana expecting a happiness that the best cooked food, cooked by the best chefs in the world, they cannot give, they can't offer. They must come into the sasana that looking for a happiness that the biggest and the grandest palace in the world cannot offer. They must come into the sasana expecting a happiness that no woman in this world can give. That is why someone should come into the sasana. My personal opinion. But what if you are someone who've never had the opportunity to experience any of those things to any extent? Then you could be someone who's still thinking that these are the things that are going to give me happiness in life. What? food, a good car, nice dwellings, and a nice woman. This can be one reason why someone comes into the sasana. So then from that day on, after they come into the sasana, now their mind is there. Their mind is always thinking about, how can I strike the next deal? Where can I get my 4x4? How can I get myself a new dwelling? How can I get myself a new TV? How can I get myself a new phone? How can I get myself a new computer? How can I build for myself a big temple? To everyone it will be different. Now I know as Ravika Mahatmya is not going to think, how can I build myself a big temple? Of course, you are not here for the temple. But you have come into the sasana. So more or less these things apply to all. More or less. It's down to each and every one of you to ask yourself, examine yourself, your purpose of coming to the sasana. But that's not to say that it is only those who come, having experienced all that, who come looking for greater pleasures, greater happiness. That is not so. There are those who come having experienced nothing, no material possessions, no material pleasures at all, but they have listened to the Dhamma, they have understood that even the things that I have not experienced, they were never going to give me happiness. So therefore I now need to seek a happiness that cannot be experienced and gained from material possessions. It's a happiness that is unconditional. They come with understanding. Sunita and Sopaka, they came into the sasana not looking for material possessions. They didn't. Because they listened to the Buddha and they understood the Dhamma. I'm talking about people who haven't understood the Dhamma and they still come into the sasana. You know, the reason I'm saying some of these things is because, you know, we are always inviting people to come to the sasana. Yeah? We are always inviting people to come and experience the joy and the bliss that the sasana has to offer. I mean, if you listen to our talks these days, you know, it's every other word is like, come to the sasana. The sasana is here for you. It's the only refuge that we have. But you must come for the right reasons. Otherwise, you get the other kind of people. There's another kind of people. They come into the sasana because they want a fast-track ticket to the four great healths. They can't wait long enough. They can't wait for another 300 lifetimes, another 500 lifetimes to go to hell. They want to go next one. So they want a fast track to the four great hells. That's one reason why some people come into the sasana. To experience what that is like. They've forgotten what the four great hells are like. Yeah, you know, these are not my words. These are the Buddha's words. The sasana is like a double-edged sword. If you're not careful with it, it's a very, very, very dangerous thing. It can cut you like a very sharp sword. You don't even know you've been cut. Because it doesn't even bleed at the beginning, because it's that sharp. But you've been cut nonetheless. As you turn around, you realize only one half of your body is turning, the other half isn't. That's when you know you've been cut. Sometimes I tell myself, the reason this is red is to remind you of that. It's very sharp. Handle with care. Both to the one bearing it and to those who come in front of it. Handle with care. So as I speak to you these words, just imagine how cautious and careful I must be bearing it. So this is not just advice I'm giving you. Don't think of it like that. I never give you advice, honestly. I share with you the advice I give myself. I don't give you advice. Who am I to give you advice? I share with you advice I give myself. So these are some of the reasons why people come into the sasana. So you have those who come in because they are too old now and they need someone to look after themselves. Then there are those who come because it's time to relax. Life has taken a huge toll on them. They're now weary and they're fragile and they're old and they're weak, right? And they just want some time to relax. There's another kind of group. They come to the sasana because they want to lay down low for a while. They're running from the law. Perhaps sometimes responsibilities. So this is not just tired working. They want to run away from the responsibilities that they got themselves into. Like marriage, for instance. There are two kinds of people who come out of a marriage into the sasana. There's one who come because they understand that marriage is not an institution that does any good to either party. Marriage is not an institution that does good to either party because it's merely a case of you scratch my back, I scratch yours. I mean, otherwise, how can two people who've been married for 20 years then decide to separate and go their own way? If that has done good to each other, how come they decide to split up? Then the longer you're together, the longer you should remain together, right? It's not so. It's simply a case of, here's my rash, show me yours, and we'll scratch each other's. For as long as we keep doing that, we can be together. I mean, I've been there, done that, so I know. Right? This is how it is. Today, I'm able to look back and reflect on the thought, on the thoughts, on the series of thoughts that arose within this body. You know, my ancestors. No, not my great-great-great-grandfather. I'm talking about my ancestors. These chittas and the chittas that came before this. I'm able to look back and reflect and ask myself, you know, am I proud of the things that I thought back then? Do I take pride in the things that I used to think about? In the ways I used to think about? You know, if I really loved someone in my life, was it right for me to say, I want you to be mine and no one else's? Today we look at things in a very different light, ladies and gentlemen. This may not appeal to society. This may not. So I have to say, if any of these talks don't appeal to you, if you feel like these talks are, you know, it's just completely tearing up the fabric of society, then unsubscribe. There's a button there. And then you won't be bothered when these talks go online. But if you hit the subscribe button and you click on that ring, that bell thing, right? That's when you're bothered. So just unbother yourselves. Unsubscribe. If I really love someone, here's what I should do. Show them how to love themselves. That's what I should do. Not go telling them, I love you. Because if I tell them, I love you, then what I'm telling them is, your happiness is dependent on me. So, if you want to be happy, keep me happy. Dirty, isn't it? I love you. Right? So, if you want to be happy, you had better keep me happy. And then you teach that. You teach that to them by giving them examples. Right? You tell them, you know, one of these days they make you unhappy. Then you prove it to them that they can only be happy if they make you happy. You know, one day you get home from work and they haven't cooked dinner. Hey, there's dinner. Sorry. Too busy. What? Too busy. Then there comes. Now you are going to prove to them that if they don't show you love, you don't show them love. That can't be love. That's ugly love. That's dirty love. That's selfish love. That is not the kind of love that I... If there was a God, I don't think that's how God would want each of us to love each other. I don't think that's how God would want us to love our fellow brothers and sisters. I think God would want us to love each other unconditionally. But I used to think that love was that. As I say, today I look back at my past and sometimes I take a sick bag with me as I reflect. Not proud. But, you know, it's what society taught me. It's what I read in the magazines, it's what I learned from TV, it's what I learned from people who taught me what love was, but because I never came across noble love until I came across the Buddha Sasana. Until I met you people, I didn't know what noble love was. I thought love was to separate someone amongst the many for yourself and then keep them for yourselves. And then make sure that no one else has them, any part of them. And their smiles and their laughs, their embraces, their kisses and their hugs were all just for me and nobody else. Otherwise, in reality, you know, when a man is old or when a man is paralyzed, right? And you can't satisfy simply even by, you know, a smile, a mere hug or an embrace, if you can't satisfy your partner, then if you really love them, you should say, move on. If this relationship doesn't make you happy, move on. But that's not what they'd want. Now if you get, that's why they sign a document. So that as long as the document is valid, you have to be with me. Many, many, many generations ago, people didn't have paperwork. Because that was not tainted love, it was not tarnished love, it was not dirty love. But today, you know, people don't have time to learn about what love is. How? Where do they get to learn it from? They don't learn about loving kindness. So how can they know what love is? They don't learn about compassion. How can they know what love is? Because they're far too busy learning what the textbook says. Life is very competitive today. You know, you don't get a mark for being compassionate, do you? If you score lower in your exam papers, can you ask for extenuating circumstances and say, but I was compassionate? Please, can I have an extra 10%? I was compassionate. On the way here, I saw a dog that had been run over. So what I did was I picked the dog up and I took it to the vet. Right? And that's why I was half an hour late for the exam. That's why I only had 2.5 of the 3 hours for the exam. That's why I couldn't answer 2 of the questions. Can I have another 10% for compassion? Do they give you that? No. The other day, Guru Handra was talking to us about how the Disapamok system worked. See, today, our young children, they don't have the time to learn about these things, which is why our program is very different. The way that we bring up our children through our Noble Hearts program and our young children who come to us, it's very different because we don't bring them up to face the competitiveness of today's world. You see, those days, young people, they used to live with their teachers. By teachers, what was meant by that, the teacher was the farmer, the teacher was the doctor, the teacher was the laborer. So they used to live together. You know, people only needed to learn as much as was needed to survive. Because their lives were dedicated for something more than simply sustenance. If we go back many generations, I mean, we probably now have to go back many generations, maybe 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 generations ago. You know, in a few years' time, they'll say 100,000 years ago, but for now, it's about 10 generations ago. Maybe a little bit more than that, actually. Maybe up to 20 generations ago. They had the Disapamok system. People knew that they came into this world, that they have come into this world to achieve a higher truth, to understand a higher truth. They realized that they'd come into this world to understand, to seek their salvation. Because right from day one, ladies and gentlemen, they had the association of the Mahasangha. People had time to go to the temple. And thus in the Sangha, Sasana, in the community, were people who had come into the Sasana for the right reasons. The eldest in the family was always given to the Sasana. therefore forming a very strong bond between the family and the sasana. The eldest was always given to the sasana. If a mother and father had three children, three boys, the first boy was always given to the sasana. He was a lokka. He was given to the sasana. So the family had a strong bond. And then the elder son, he would make sure that the rest of the family always got the Dhamma. There was a reason for them to now associate the temple very closely. Weekly, if not daily, they would go to the temple, or the Swaminansi would come home. But and those days people used to be proud of the fact that one of us is in the sasana. Today, just think about what most parents are proud about. My son is where? He's a doctor. My son is in America. My son is on the moon, they'll say soon enough. Sometimes these days, some parents, they may feel a little bit embarrassed to say that we only have two children. But I thought you had three. Yeah, one went to the sasana. Two. One's a doctor, the other's a lawyer. The other son, we don't talk about him. Went to the sasana. Pity. It's come to that point. Only because of the reputation that the sasana holds today. And the reputation that people have, remember, it's not that there's the sasana and there's the people. The people make the sasana. Now, where do we get people into the sasana from? Mass? It's the people, right? It's the common people. They make the sasana. So for whatever purpose and reason you have come into the sasana, that is what represents the sasana today. So when people, their competitive lifestyles drain from them their youthfulness, their energy, their passion for life, their purpose, and now all that is left is just an old and rotten body that is just barely alive. And if that is why now for refuge you go into the sasana, then that becomes the sasana. You make what the sasana is. Of course, the Buddha, he discovered the Dhamma and he passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage. But it's what people today, in this day and age, go into the sasana for. That is what represents the sasana. So like I said, many generations ago, people realized that they had a bigger purpose in life. After they were born, soon enough, their elder siblings, their teachers, or rather their parents, would teach them, "Putra, my dear child, there's a greater truth that we all need to understand." They used to talk about the Buddha. In every home, they had a Buddha statue. They talked about the Buddha, they talked about the Dhamma, they talked about the Sangha. They'd introduce the little one to the to the monk from the temple, and they'd have a strong and close relationship. So this little one, he grew up, his formative years, her formative years were dedicated to recognizing and realizing the purpose of life. But of course you needed to learn so that you could earn a living. You had to learn something, and that something you could learn just by being with your teacher. Because who was the teacher? The teacher was the blacksmith, and that was enough to get by. The teacher was the farmer, that was enough to get by. The teacher was the village doctor, that was enough to get by. That was enough. Because that was all it was, a living. You were there to make a living, not make a life. Make a living. These are two different things, aren't they? But today, life is very complex, very sophisticated, and very complicated. Exams weren't this tough back then. Because now everyone's competing. That's why they're called competitive exams. Go ask your great-grandmother. Sorry, I know you can't. But if you did, and if you could, she would say, competitive exams? Exams are competitive? What's that? Because today you have many competing for few. So it has to be competitive. Back then it was not so. There was no notion of competing with each other, because in competition there was always going to be a winner and a loser. Back then no one wanted anyone to lose out, because such was their love. Today, how can you say that, you know, if your child is in a classroom, right? Your child is in a classroom of 50. And there's only one position. The top position. There's only one of them. And there's a classroom of 50. 50 of them taking the exam, one of them can qualify for that position. How can you honestly say that your child wishes the best and well for everyone else? Because that is not the kind of attitude that parents would put into his mind. Have you not heard of stories where children today, in fact, it is because our parents teach them not to share their books with others, not to share their stationery with others. I remember from when I was at school, and that was what, 15 years ago, something like that, when I was at school. Sorry, can you tell them not to make that noise, please? Otherwise, there will be no end of editing this to get the noise out. What was I saying? At school, yes. So, I remember when I was at school. This is when I was at school, right? Not yesterday. When I was at school, there were children. Is that an animal? And then you can't do anything about it. When I was at school, there were those who would purposely, when asked a question, give the wrong answer. I can't call them friends, because friends don't do that kind of thing. But they were children in the classrooms, right? When asked a question, something they know, something you know they know, but they give you the wrong answer. They purposely teach you the wrong thing, so that in your exams, you'll fail. So where do they pick up these things? I mean, just think about, is that why they've been born human? If that was 15 years ago, just imagine what things must be like today. Competitiveness. Because few positions and a lot of people want to get there. Why? Because when you get there, you get prestige, you get honor, you get respect, you get money, you get wealth, and you know, it's not sufficient today to just have, you know, it's not sufficient just to have your sustenance. It's not enough today for people just to have somewhere to live, is it? It's not enough for people just to have something to eat. It's not enough for people to simply have something to wear, and if you're unwell, then some treatment, some medicine to heal you. It's not enough. Because today you can't simply have a house, it has to be a mansion. So if it has to be a mansion, then you have to compete for the top places where they give you enough to make those mansions, where you can earn enough to build those mansions. And today it's not enough to say that my son works in the neighboring town. It has to be in America. It has to be in Australia. It has to be in the UK. It has to be some other part of the world. So therefore, to get there, of course, they have to compete. See, if all your child had to do was to get to the best, position in this land, right? You only have to compete with the people who live here. But now if your child has to get to some position, to some company in another part of the world, now they have to compete with not just people here, but also people who live in that country. So therefore, their education has to be the number one thing in their lives. So now you can't learn from the Disapamuk. Because the Disapamuk is not here to teach you how to get to the top positions in the top companies. in blue chip companies. Yeah, the Isapamok is here to teach you how to get by, how to make ends meet, how to ensure that there's food on the plate. That's what the Disabhamukhi is here to teach. How to give freely. The village doctor never used to charge money. Their service was exchanged for a heap of betel leaves, because that was meant to represent gratitude. That is how service used to be. Service with a smile. Today you don't get that. You can't. Because today, life is very competitive. I think I'm right in saying this, and forgive me if I'm wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong. I think today, parents, there are parents in the room, you bring your children into this world, and you're having to get them to live a life that you really don't want them to live. You really don't want this life for them, but you are left with no choice. You don't want them to be so competitive. You don't want them to be so selfish. You want them to be more caring and more sharing and more generous, and get along with each other. But it is such that you have brought them into a world where everything is so competitive, everything is so complicated, and to survive today, it is such people believe that they have to get to those top positions in the top companies. You have to be a doctor. There's no other way to succeed in life. You have to be an engineer. You have to be a lawyer. There's no other way to be successful in life, because that is what everyone expects you to make your child, a doctor. And, you know, right from when a child is young. I remember when I was growing up, people used to come and ask me, Putra, when you grow up, don't you want to be a doctor? That was how they phrased the question. Don't you want to be a doctor? And again, forgive me, but I don't think that being a doctor today is synonymous with don't you want to be someone who can heal people. I don't think that's what they mean. I don't think so. I don't think that's what they mean when they say don't you want to be a doctor. I think they're talking about the prestige that comes with it, the honor that comes with it, the respect that comes with it, the financial success that comes with it, that sort of thing. Which is a shame. I mean, look at where today the profession of a doctor is. This is how low it has stooped to. That is not how it used to be. The village doctor was a very respected man. A very respected man. Their service was always for free, because they realized that their purpose in life was to earn merit so that they could attain Nibbana. So they exchanged wellness for wellness. There are many good doctors out there, even to this day, right? When they see a person, a man in need, they will go the extra mile on their behalf. I mean, even when our Swami Mohan says, Anagarika, Anagarika Mahatmyas, they go to the hospitals, right? You know, they know that there is nothing that we can give them besides the Dhamma, besides our blessings. And still, they're more than happy to waive their fees and so on. So I witness that, and I rejoice in that I do. And if there are people who cannot afford, right, and if they make it known, then I'm sure there are many doctors out there who will say, don't worry about it, right? We are human beings, I'm here to serve, right? There are many who do that. But I think that is becoming a rarity now. There are, but they are few and far between. But many generations ago, that was the norm. Teachers. Today, teachers are a very different kind of beast. It has become a transaction. All because, you know, we have forgotten the foundations of Metta, Karuna, Mudita and Upekkha. Our ancestors built our lives on those foundations, be it Nibbana or no Nibbana. But the thing is, you know, back then people, they realized that they have come into this world as human beings to attain Nibbana. They knew that. They knew that. They were at their core truth seekers. You know, it might even seem very difficult to believe these words. You might feel like, you know, I'm not in touch with with reality. You might think so. But the honest truth is, ladies and gentlemen, if, you know, back then, people, the reason that you didn't have sky rises, the reason that you didn't have mansions back then, if you go back, you know, several hundred years into history, you don't have the mansions that stand tall today. Those days, people used to make structures that lasted long enough so that they could live in them, take shelter, because they didn't want to make anything to last. They hadn't come into this world to last. They had come to this world for the last time. Thus, they knew that. Credit where it's deserved. They knew that. I'm talking about your forefathers. I'm talking about your bloodline. I'm talking about your great-great-great-grandfather. He knew that he'd come into this world not to last, but for the last time. So to whatever extent they could, they wanted to be charitable, they wanted to be generous, they wanted to embrace human values. I know I can't change the world. I don't think even you and I together we can change the world, but we can change the world for you. We can change your world. We can change the world out there, but we can change your world because you have begun to build a little monastery. That monastery is now your world, isn't it? This monastery that you're building in your hearts, that is now your world. That world we can construct, we can design, we can engineer, we can build it as we want it. That's why today, our children who are with us today, you know, we subscribe to the Disarpamukha structure. They are with us. They learn how to get by. They learn how to make sure that there's a meal on the plate. They learn how to make sure that when they're ill, when they're sick, how to get the treatment that they need. They learn how to put a roof above their heads. They learn all that. Our children are very skilled. We teach them everything. All of the life skills. You take one of these young children and put them in the middle of the forest, they'll survive without killing a single animal. Yeah, human beings are meant to be like that. You know, we are intelligent species. We don't need to kill to live. That is a practice reserved for, you know, lowly beings, and therefore, in animals and so on. Human beings don't need to do that. So we teach our children that because we need the time that they need. We want to give them the time that they need to attain their salvation, which is why we have all come into this world. But as I said earlier, I know that as parents, you have had to put your children through this run-of-the-mill, this dog-eat-dog world, this rat race of a life, and I know that that is not what you want for them. It is true, it is not what you want for them. But thankfully you came across the Dhamma, you came across the teaching, and you came across the Sasana. So today you see an alternative. But just go back, take yourselves back to before you found the Dhamma. There will be parents here who have given the gift of the Sasana to their children, but that was all because you came across the Sasana. That was all because you came across the Dhamma. Had you not come across the Dhamma, where would your son be right now? Where would your daughter be right now? She'd either be there or she'd be on the way there. Where? America, Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom. That's where your daughter would be if she's not there already. But see how the course of their life changed. The trajectory of their life completely changed. And now you've given them a true purpose, something meaningful. Something you know will actually bring them happiness and joy. What's the point of being rich if you die unhappy? Not all the money in the world can put a smile on your face. Some of the richest people we know have died weeping and grieving and sorrowful. These are not the things that bring us happiness. I have come into the Sasana to achieve a happiness that money cannot bring. In fact, I am not content with the happiness that money can bring. So money can't make me happy. We need money. Money is what put these walls up. Money is what turns the fans. Money is what turns the lights on. It's what rolls the camera and switches, make sure that this voice gets captured there. That's what, it's money that does that. It's money that keeps you comfortable. It's money that put a seat under you. Money is, it is money that does that. So we need money, but not for happiness. It's to put those things up there. I don't consider myself wealthy today. I used to think I was. But I don't consider myself poor either. Whether you're wealthy or poor is determined by your relationship with money. Today I don't have relationship with money. I divorced her. So I don't have a relationship with money. But it is used. Fortunately, I don't have to deal with it. We have the charity trust. And the money that they have there, they spend on building this monastery so that we can all come and seek refuge and practice the path. And the money that is there is the money that you have offered. It is your donations. And as people come into the sasana, they do what they can. Many of you, as you jump over the other side of the fence, right, as and when you can, and whatever you can, people make such offerings to the sasana. So that you build this ship that every one of us can travel in. That's the way it works. But we don't have a relationship with money. It's not a love-hate relationship. It's there. We use it. Because money doesn't make us happy. I didn't come into the sasana. In fact, I came into the sasana to seek a happiness that the best, the most delicious food in the world couldn't offer. So I am not content with whatever food can give. The happiness, the pleasures, the deliciousness that food can give, I am not content with that. That's why I came into the sasana. Because that was not enough. I was not content with the happiness that a woman could give. I wanted more than that. So I didn't come into the sasana because I was old. I needed someone to look after me. Or I had got fed up with life. Or I was running away from responsibilities. I did not come into the sasana to lay down, run from the law. That's not what that was for. It was not so that I could be respected. I didn't come for the glory or the honor. No. I didn't come into the sasana for any of those things. I didn't come into the sasana for a defender. I mean, the things that run on four wheels, those defenders. I didn't come into the sasana for that. That's not to say that if anyone travels in one, they have come in for that. You can't say that. We are not entitled to make judgments. But we have not come into the sasana for that. We have come into the sasana for one thing and one thing alone. To build the palace of Nibbana on the four pillars, Metta, Karuna, Mudita and Upekkha. The Satra Satipatthana, to keep us within the Buddha's premises. And we are building up those four walls. And as we practice the path, we are sheltered by Raga, Dvesha and Moha. Or sheltered from Raga, Dvesha and Moha. And finally we're going to have the roof that go up, that is going to be the roof of Nibbana. And one fine day, the roof will be done. And then our task will be done. But while we build this monastery, we want to make it big enough so that there's room for everyone in it. It's no good just building a monastery for one person. I mean, for some people, if they can manage that, that's also great. It's good, right? If you can build a monastery for one person, that's also good. But we feel that our purpose here is not just to build a monastery for one person. Within each and every one of us, it would be great if you can have room for at least one more person. And they need not be related to you. Remember that. You know, you can come in if you are my ex-husband. No, that's not what we're talking about. You can come in if you are my son. You can come in if you are my daughter. That is the kind of building that people build outside. You can come in if you are related to me. That's not what we're talking about here. You can come in if you want the Buddha's refuge. You can come in if you want, if you take the Dhamma as your refuge. You can come in if Nibbana is what you seek. Then you're all welcome. So as bearers of prayer mats, what have you come into this asana for? What do you seek from this asana? We bring up our children in the model of the Disapama because we see them as the great leaders of the Sambuddha Sasana in the future. Children today, they say, you know, children are man's gift, you know, gift of humankind, and this is true. But we see that with our children, they will one day go on to become the great arahants that will roam the surface of this earth, because that is the upbringing that we want to give them. It's all of us who work on them together. It's not just Guru Swami Nuhansi or myself or anyone like that. This is a collective effort. Because this is the monastery that we are building so that everyone can come in. So for each and every one of you, you will have a tale to tell. You will have a purpose of why you have come into this asana. And that purpose, you have to be happy with. It's not for me. It's for you. Are you happy with that purpose? If you feel that you are genuinely happy with that purpose, then fabulous. If today you look back as to why you came into the sasana initially, but then you contemplate on, have my actions been congruent with that? Have my actions represented that? Have my actions reflected why I came into the sasana in the first place? And you begin to wonder, I don't know. I came into the sasana because I wanted Nibbana, but today, is that what I'm doing? Have I become a bit unwieldy? Have I become someone, my teachers are really struggling to tame? Only you have the answer. Have I become someone who is always looking for glory, who is looking for respect, who is looking for fame and respect, and looking for my dignity from others? Is that what I'm here for? Do I want myself to be held in high regard, or am I okay with absolutely anything? Am I content with the food that gets served? Or every day as food gets served into my alms bowl, do I think to myself, another day, same thing. When do these devotees... When do these devotees actually offer something I can eat? Are you there? Or are you content? Ask yourself, just ask yourself. If ever you feel that way, just ask yourself, why did I come into the sasana? Did I come into the sasana to complain about the food I eat? Did I come into the sasana to complain about the robes that I wear? My robe is old now. It's patched up everywhere. It's falling off all the time. Why don't they get me a new robe? Can't these devotees see this? And then, if you begin to feel that way, then you start doing your talks in ways that you kind of imply that you need one. Wouldn't it be nice if all of you felt like it was time to offer a robe? There are a lot of merits in offering robes, ladies and gentlemen. Ask yourself, all the time, ask yourself. As I said, examine every thought that passes through your mind. Every thought counts. It's every thought that has that takes you to Nibbana. It's every thought. It's like if you are on a journey to get somewhere, ladies and gentlemen, until you get there, every step matters, doesn't it? You're here and you want to get there. Every step matters. It's not every second step that matters, is it? See, you put two steps forward, one step back. Which of those steps mattered? Two steps forward, one step back. Altogether, how many steps? Three. Which one of those three mattered? All three. Two took you closer, one took you back. So now, if you're on the journey to Nibbana, which of your thoughts matter? Which ones? Everyone, right? Every thought matters. Yes, I mean, you know, if you're a bit relaxed, it'll happen for you eventually, but when is eventually? All you can be assured of is what you have right now. Who's to say that we are going to have the same environment, the same noble companionship, the same everything that we have today when our lights go out? Who's to say we are going to have the same things? What we have now, but even that you're not sure until for how long. Each of these things, they have an expiry date. Each of these things, your teacher has an expiry date. Noble companionship has an expiry date. The Buddha Sasana has an expiry date. Your merits, they have an expiry date. All of these things, they have an expiry date. You have an expiry date. When you expire, everything else expires along with it. Just imagine a tree. You have a tree. Here are the roots, right? Here's the branches of the tree and the leaves, and there it bears a lot of fruit, right? Just imagine this part of the tree is meant to last 100 years. Okay. The root though will only last 10 years. How long do you think this tree is going to last? 10. But this is going to last for 100 years. The wood is solid. So say someone's put some kind of chemical at the base of the tree, and what that means is in the next 10 years the roots will die. And they won't grow any further. So now it matters not that the rest of the tree will last 100 years, because this will only last 10. So this sasana apparently is meant to last another 2,500 years. You? So this part, 2,500 years. This part? Does it matter how long the Buddha sasana will last when you're gone? No. If you are only going to live for another 10 years, then it matters not how long the Buddha sasana is going to last after those 10. Because you can't gain from it. You are not going to benefit from it. That's why I say, each of these things, they have an expiry date, but they're all surpassed by this expiry date. When this expires, the rest of it expires. It matters not how long the other part will last. So please examine every single thought. Once again, I'll be the first to say that it's not easy. It is not easy. It's not meant to be easy. It's not easy. If it were easy, everyone would be doing it. How many people are working to Nibbana? If you have the Mahameru, which represents every person in this world, then you have a grain of sand which would compare to all the people in the world who are striving for salvation. Even less than that. So if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. It's not easy because we've never done this before. And more so than that, people just don't have the merits to come across noble companionship, which reminds you and teaches you, instructs you and guides you to do this and make this your life, your livelihood. Think about it, in the Noble Eightfold Path, you have Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappa, Samma Vacha, Samma Vayama, Samma Ajiva. This is livelihood. See, what does that tell you? Nibbana has to become your livelihood. It has to become your life. That's what it means. It has to become your life. If it's the Noble Eightfold Path that gets you from a Pratakjana to an Arahant, right? It has to become your life. Not a day or two. Not a weekend. Not a poya day. not on a vacation. It has to become your life. It's far easier to do this if you're on this side of the fence. But even if you're on the other side of the fence, Nibbana is your attitude. If you examine each and every thought that passes your mind and be responsible for those thoughts and check yourself, is this a thought that has raga within it? Is this a thought that has dvesha in it? Is this a thought that has moha in it? Do I have thoughts of lust and desire? If you sense that, you have to soon enough start contemplating on anicca, dukkha and anatta. If you have thoughts of anger, if anger creeps in, ladies and gentlemen, you know, don't wait until it's the following day. You've got to do it then and there. Because it has to be your livelihood. Nibbana is putting out, extinguishing. When do you extinguish a fire? After it is burnt out, you go into the kitchen and you see a fire. When are you going to put it out? After you have a cup of tea and a biscuit? No, you're going to put it out then and there, right? So Nibbana is the same. Nibbana is putting out. So when you see a fire, you have to put it out then and there. This is what I mean by be mindful, be mindfully aware of every thought that passes your mind. Saragangva chittang, saragang chittanti pajanati. Not tomorrow, when the saragika chitta is there. For that you need a bit of practice. But how do you get practice? The other day someone came and asked me, "Sir, Swaminathan, sir, I still struggle to practice. Like, it's still difficult to practice when I have lustful thoughts and I have anger, you know, I still struggle to practice. How should I get better at it?" So I asked this Anagarika Mahatya this question. I asked him, "How did you learn to walk? Did you learn to walk and then walk? Or did you learn walking? How did you guys learn to walk? Did you take lessons first and then you got on your feet and started walking? How did you learn to swim? You took lessons, you first learned to swim on the shore and then you got into the water and started swimming one fine day. Is that how it worked? No. How did you learn reading? You first learned how to read and then you read. Is that how you learned to read? How did you learn just about anything? How do you learn cycling? How do you learn cooking? How do you learn walking? How do you learn to run? How do you learn to do anything? You learn it by doing it, right? There you go. How do you learn math? By studying history. No, you learn math by working the sums. So how do you learn Nibbana? Saragangva chittang, saragang chittanti pajanati. That's how you learn. When a thought with desire arises, you need to catch it. You need to reflect. You need to acknowledge this is a thought that has raga, that has desire within it. You need to capture it. You need to be sensitive to that. As I say, be mindful and watchful. Be vigilant of every thought that passes your mind. I know the moment I said, you're like, Swaminathan, how can you do that? But you've got to be thinking about everything. You've got to drive. You've got to eat. You've got to cook. You've got to wash. You know, you've got to wash up. You've got to watch the children. You've got to tea. How many things must I have to do? And on top of all that, I have to also be saragangva chittang. How do I do all that? How do you breathe? Aren't you too busy to breathe? Aren't you? I've never heard you complain. Swaminathan, too busy to breathe. We have to look after the children, we have to wash the dishes, we have to cook the food, I have to look after my ailing mother. And then I have to go places, I have to do the shopping. You also want me to breathe as well? Never heard anyone complain. But did you know that you're actively doing it? It's not a passive thing, it's an active thing. You're doing it. That's why a dead body doesn't breathe. You're actively doing it. There's a chitta that's responsible. for your inhalation and exhalation. There are chittas that do it. That's why you stop the chitta, respiration stops. Inhalation, exhalation stops. Saragang vachittang, saragang chittanti bhajanati has to happen the same way. There's not going to be a separate time for you to isolate yourself from all the things that you do and then sit down and go, where's my saragika chitta? Come on you, saragika chitta, come on now, I'm waiting for you, I've been waiting for 2 hours now, come on you. It won't come like that. Your saragika chitta won't come like that. It will come when the conditions are right. Because it is not you who is saragika. Saragika is one of, you know, with desire. That's what saragika means, with desire. The state of being with desire. Vitaraga is without desire. Sadosa is with aversion. Vitadosa is without aversion. Samoha is with delusion and Vitamoha is without delusion. That is it. So your saragika chitta is not going to come to you when you want it. then of course, I mean, if everything that you happen that you want happens, then just want Nibbana and that's it, right? I want Vitaraga, Vitadosa, Vitamoha. Alright, 3, 2, 1, go. Ta-da, Nibbana. Doesn't work like that. Because all things are conditioned. Here's the thing. When a saragika chitta arises, as in a chitta with desire arises, here's what you're supposed to do. Understand that it's conditioned. Simple. You know, we call these things buildings, don't we? These are buildings. See, the word building is both a noun and a verb, isn't it? This is a building. We call this a noun, it's a building. But you see someone laying bricks, what are they doing? They're building. The truth is, this building is building. Right now. You think it's a ready-made building. It's not. It's building. This noun is verb. This building is building. Right now. In other words, these causes are coming together constantly to manifest this product. That's what's going on right now. You're alive. That's not a state. That's a process. Right now, you're being kept alive. It is a very momentary thing. In every moment, there are the conditions that keep you alive, and that is why you're alive. In the same way, when a saragika chitta arises, means a chitta with raga arises, don't fear. The Buddha is here. You need not worry. Don't run away. Don't dread. You need not. Right? You don't have to go like screaming and like, oh my God, I had a saragika chitta. You don't need to do that. Just recognize that a saragika chitta has arisen. Reflect. Contemplate a bit through the lens of anicca. It's a building. A building of a saragika chitta. Not the noun, the verb. Here's a building of a saragika chitta. A saragika chitta is being created. It's happening. The conditions are giving rise to a saragika chitta. It's being constructed. Hetum paticca sambhutam. That is what's going on. Causes are creating and manifesting a product. And the saragika chitta is the same. See, the moment you reflect, you contemplate on that, here's what happens. You shift from a paradigm of entities to a paradigm of manifestations because of causes. Your saragika chitta can only survive for as long as you are ignorant. Remember, samma ditti, samma sankappa, therefore, micchā ditti, micchā sankappa. Saragika is a micchā sankappa. Your raga chetana, your desirous thoughts, your lustful thoughts are all based on the premise that there are entities in this world. So when you have a view that is based in entities, you are susceptible to raga, dvesha and moha. So what is the remedy then? You simply need to change your view, that's it. So how do you change your view? That is what the Dhamma does. So this is why being vigilant is so important. Until you are able to do this on your own, a teacher will be there to guide you. So, you know, I know that some of you spend most of your time listening to sermons. It's good, because in the sermons they constantly keep reminding you, right? Raga, desha, moha. These are conditioned things. Vita raga, vita dosa, vita moha. Also conditioned things, because conditioned, again, chittas. Without a chitta, you can't have vita raga. It's a viraga ka chitta. That's what you have. So, whenever you get into this state of mind where you have a desire towards anything, right? It could be any, absolutely anything. If it's something you like to look at, it's something you like to smell, something you like to taste. You walk past the fridge and you feel that attraction towards the fridge. You look at a bunch of flowers and you want to keep looking at that. You look at your child, your son, your daughter, and you want that. You want to hug him, caress him. You want to do all that, right? All of these times you're having a saragika chitta. You know, these are not just like dirty, lewd thoughts. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about lust. I'm talking about raga. Even anagami individuals have raga. I'm not talking about dirty lust. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about, you know, the lowly sensual forms of that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about raga. Raga is the desire to associate. The wanting to associate. That is what raga is. If you want to associate something, if the mind wishes to associate something, wants to associate something, that is a thought, that is a mind that is suffering from raga. I say suffering from because as a result of that you suffer. Because in this chitta, raga arises because you see an entity. The object that you wish to associate with, you see as an entity. That's why raga arises. See, when you see your little one and you want to squeeze his cheeks, right, and you see, oh, so cute, cuddly, that's because you're seeing an entity. What you don't see at that moment are conditions creating a manifestation. You don't see that. You remember at that point that you both ate of the same rice pot. You forget at that time that it is the same carbons and the hydrogens and the oxygens and the nitrogens that make you, that make me. So how come there is a little cute and cuddly little thing that I want to squeeze? Where did that come from? Your eyes can only see bits of color. That's all your eyes show you. But in your mind, you aggregate all of these things. You bring in data from your memory banks. You bring in your drishti. You wind it and bind it all together. And then you weave in your mind, like the spider weaves a web and lives in it. You weave in your mind all of these, this Apo, Tejo, Vayo, Patavi, the four elements that exist outside, you give it a meaning that is not actually out there. You create that in your own mind. See, that is the entity that you just created. That's the entity you created. Now, for an arahant, they also see. They see a form. They see a form, but they know that it's a form. What do I mean by form here? Yes, a shape, right? A rupa. Not the form that you fill in. Form. You see that form. An arahant recognizes a form. Through wisdom they understand that this is merely a form. But here's where, without wisdom, you fail. Without wisdom, in your ignorant, you see it as an entity. What is an entity? An entity is a fixed object. Where do those things exist? Nowhere. They don't exist anywhere. They only exist in your fantasies. But as you perceive one, because that is what the mind wants. Remember, when the mind goes crazy, it creates whatever it wants, right? So when the mind wants it, it creates it in its own mind, in itself, and then it projects that. It projects that onto the outside world, and now you think that entity that you created in your mind is what is out there. See, for example, just to give you an idea. What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? A line. Is that all you see? Did I draw what you see right now? Did I? No. What did I draw? A circle. I drew another circle. I drew a line. And I drew another line. But you see something else here. You think that each of these things belong to something. Yeah? So now, if I ask you, what did I just do? What did I just do? I covered the left eye. Did I draw an eye? No, I just drew a circle. But when I cover the circle, you should be saying, Swaminas, you just covered the circle. That's not what you're saying. You're saying, I covered the eye. And in fact, you say it's the left eye as well. How did this become the left eye? So if this is the left eye, then that is the right eye, meaning these two things belong to something. Where did that come from? I never drew that. You created it in your mind. Because here's what happens. Your eyes can only bring you pigments, or actually not the pigments, but light rays reflected off pigments. They bring you individual pieces of data. But in your mind, you're constantly adding up what you see. You're aggregating what you see based on data that you have in your memory. Right? This is a constant. Your computers are the fastest computers that there will ever be. There cannot be a faster computer than your supercomputer. Because that frequency of data analysis and data aggregation and transforming data into information, it cannot happen at that rate anywhere. It's faster than the speed of light. When you see this, the moment I drew this line, this became a face for you. It didn't even take a split second. So it didn't actually start when I drew that line. Every time I drew an object, you go back into your memory and ask yourself, what is that? What is that part of? What does it belong to? This what does it belong to always keeps coming in your mind. See, when I show you this, it's not just a bit of plastic. It is a cap that belongs to a pen somewhere. An arahant would also say that. If I show this to an arahant, the arahant would also say, that looks like a cap of a pen. Yes. But an arahant does not perceive that this whole thing is one entity. They see this as a manifestation. This is simply an aggregation of discrete things together. In the same way, if you ask from an arahant, what have I drawn on the board? The arahant will also say, it looks like you've drawn a face. But the arahant does not perceive an entity. See, we suffer, now if this is your face, and someone cut you, right, with the blade. Now you're hurt. You're hurt because you sense that this face is my face. Where does that my come from? Where did that sense of self come from? Where did this, the owner of this face, where did that come from? These are all your perceptions. The arahant doesn't perceive any of that. They don't feel that these all are part of one entity. But they understand this, that a face is made up of two eyes, a nose and a mouth. An arahant understands that. So if an arahant sees a man with only one eye, they're not going to say that is a fully formed being. They're going to say that one eye is missing. It's not about knowledge. Okay? The arahant does not differ to us in terms of what knowledge we and the arahant has. It differs in the way that they perceive. Their perception is different. The perception of an entity, that is the only thing that they don't have. The perception of an entity. Because of the perception of an entity, what happens is when something happens to this, any part of this, they feel like it is the whole thing that is being disformed. Or rather deformed, sorry. The whole thing is being deformed. they feel like something's breaking here. Something's falling apart. Right? Something's falling apart. This entity projection is what does not happen in an arahant, but happens in a mind that is either a seka or a prutakjana. And this entity happens because the mind always seeks to create an entity. Like I said, when you squeeze your child's cheek and you think, my child is there, let's be honest, you know, that sense of, here's a child, my child, none of that is there. It's not there, it's a creation of your mind. If that were there, right, how can a mother ever sometimes, you know, you might end up with the wrong child because they cross your child with someone else at the hospital. How can that happen? If your child is in the child, how can that ever happen? There are some children who are adopted at a very young age. Right? They're adopted. They're too young to even know that they're adopted. And I know someone who comes from a family like that. The boy doesn't know that he's been adopted. But parents do, and the parents have shared it with their closest friends. But the child doesn't know that they're adopted. To the child, they feel no different. Like I feel towards my mother, this child feels towards his mother. They don't know. So if this motherliness is something in the mother, I don't mean the biology. I don't mean that. If this motherness is in the mother, then the child should be able to pick up the fact that this is not my mother. They don't, because it's a creation of the mind. So once the mind creates that, the mind projects it. Now, just think about it. When the child's actual mother dies, you think the boy is going to cry? Is it? No. But then when this woman, the mother who has adopted, the adopted mother, if she dies, now the boy is going to grieve. So at the death of which does the child cry? Which object? The actual mother? No. The one who he thinks is a mother. See? So if it's possible to think of someone as a mother, then aren't you going to agree with me that a mother is merely a creation of a thought? If you can think of someone as a mother, right, and then there's mother, and all the interactions with the mother, then aren't you going to agree with me that this sense of mother is merely a creation of a thought? Other than that, there's just the biological connection. That is there. Of course, if you kill your mother, your actual mother, then that's a heinous sin, right? That no one can deny. That is a biological connection. But that's not what I'm talking about. An arahant doesn't cry when his mother dies. Someone who has understood the Dhamma does not cry when his or her mother dies. That is because to an arahant, he doesn't perceive them as anything more than knowledge. By knowledge, he knows that this is a biological mother. This is the mother that has given birth to me. That he knows. But what he doesn't perceive is the way in which you and I perceive a mother. That entity of a mother, that the arahant does not perceive. All of that is a creation of the mind. To have this understanding is to be free. These are the four walls, as I said, that we need to build up on the base of the four noble abodes. In other words, metta, karuna, mudita and upeksha. Please examine yourselves. Make sure that in every thought you contemplate, you check yourself. Am I acting with metta? To whatever degree you understand it. Like I said, I can't give you a lecture on metta. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do that. Metta is not something I can speak to you and come to an end, because it is like the vast ocean. I haven't fully understood metta myself. Because if I have understood metta, I have understood the Buddha. The Buddha is metta. The Buddha is compassion, the Buddha is karuna, the Buddha is mudita, the Buddha is upeksha. He is the epitome of it. By he, I mean Buddhahood. So I don't think I can ever talk to you and give you a full exposition of what metta, karuna, mudita and upeksha are. But you will all understand it to some extent. And to whatever extent you understand it, have that as the basis of your practice. It is so important you do that. Think about who you are to others. Think about how you come across to others. Which I know you do, but I'm just saying, good that you do it. Keep on doing that. That has to be the foundation of it. your selflessness, your compassion, your kindness towards others. To the extent that you understand it, do it. Now when we do Arya Maitri, there may be some who might not really understand what is the difference between Maitri and Arya Maitri. What's this? What are these two things? If that is a question that is still that still remains with you, it's okay. Let time answer that for you. For the time being, do the metta that you can. If you feel that metta is spreading loving kindness and helping others and being good to other people and so on, then do that. That will pave the path for you to understand what noble compassion is one day. But without that, you are never going to get to a state of mind where you can absorb and understand and assimilate nobleness. Sometimes I wonder whether I'm speaking to the wrong crowd, because you know, you've all come a long way on this path, right? And for you, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha are probably second nature now. And that's great. But continue on that. Don't ever forget your roots. That's where we started. That's where we started. We started by being kind to others. Think about the first day you walked in through those gates. And you were impressed by the kindness and the compassion that people showed you. That is what kept you here. You might have heard a Dhamma sermon somewhere and you decided to come to the monastery. But what kept you here was that loving kindness, was the compassion that you experienced. Right? So if that is what brought you here and kept you here, then be more of that. So in this monastery that you build within your hearts, ensure that these are the four pillars around which you build the four walls of Kaya Anupassana, Chitta Anupassana, Veda Anupassana and Dhamma Anupassana. What those four things are will become obvious to you. In fact, that is what we do every day. When I say saragangma chittang saragang chittanti pajanati, I'm talking about chitta anupassana. Anicca dukkha and anatta is all you need. When anicca dukkha and anatta works within you, these four things happen. You don't need to consciously do it. Does that make sense? You don't need to consciously do chitta anupassana. Just reflect on anicca dukkha and anatta. When you reflect on a body, that is kaya anupassana. Even if you look at this pen, and you contemplate it through the lens of anicca, that is kaya anupassana. Your kaya anupassana does not have to be with this body. Kaya is an aggregation. Everywhere is a kaya. Vedana is a kaya. Kaya is a kaya. Rupa is a kaya. The eye is a kaya. A kaya is an aggregation. This microphone is a kaya. This building is a kaya. All kaya. Kaya is an, it's a body, it's an aggregation. This is a kaya. This is a kaya. See, this is a kaya, an aggregation. So what is kaya anupassana then? Look at the parts and contemplate on how this is a manifestation of the parts working together. It's not a face. It's not a unit of a face. It's a manifestation of a face. That is kaya anupassana. See, you did it a moment ago without even knowing you were doing kaya anupassana, because you were looking at it through the lens of anicca. That's what I mean. You know, if you have the foundations of metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha, the Dhamma will come and sit as bricks around these four pillars, right, in the rightful places. You don't need to worry about that. It's like if you have the structure, if you have the base, then as the bricks get thrown at you during a sermon, during your own contemplation, they will come and sit themselves right round in the places that they should. You needn't worry about that. Just make sure that your conduct, your attitude is always the right one. Just worry about that. Have your intentions pure. Like I always say, the only thing you can be responsible for are your intentions. Nothing more. You can't be responsible for the outcome of an action, because there are a million other causes that could affect that, right? You want to give someone something, you think you're giving them a hot beverage, but they drink it and they die. You don't realize that just a moment before you give it, you gave it to them, someone put something into it, or maybe, you know, something fell into it, and that was a bit of poison, and now they're dead. Can you be responsible for that? You can't be responsible for the outcome of your actions. You can only be responsible for your intentions. As long as you are responsible for your intentions, let the outcomes be whatever they are. Because you can't be responsible for them. That is the nature of anicca. The doctor performs an operation. Right? It's a brain surgery to help them recover their paralyzed legs. But as a result of that surgery, the man dies. Is the doctor responsible? It depends who you ask, right? You ask the lawyers, they say the doctor is responsible and they have to pay compensation. But the doctor is only responsible for their intentions. Perhaps the doctor will have to pay compensation. That's not because of what happened right now. It's because of something they've done in the past. That time they were not responsible for their intentions. Now they're having to pay for that. This is simply the current manifestation of causes of an environment which is working to pull those vipakas. That's all. Sometimes it looks like all things are connected in one way, right? Sometimes it feels like they're not connected. But ultimately, you know, how vipaka chooses to come to fruition is not a science or a logic that we can understand. In which order, in which sequence, how they work. Sometimes you go and do something with the best of intentions, but the whole thing collapses. What do? You try and help someone cross the street, but a whole army dies. You can only be responsible for your intentions. So, the long and short of today. Ask yourself why you have come into this asana, because you all have. And like I said, I was not just talking to the monks or the anagarikas. And the anagarikas, I'm talking to all of you, Sri Sravakas, Sravikas, Vaisis, and our devotees, Upasakas and Upasikas. Why have you come into this asana? Some of this may be more relatable to our monks, but it applies to all. Think of why you have come into this asana. Make sure that as you build up this monastery of yours in your heart, it is based in metta, karuna, mudita, and upeksha. You need not fear, need not worry when raga chitta arises, when a dvesha chitta arises, when a moha chitta arises. You don't need to worry about it. No need to scream from the top of your heads and run around like headless chicken. You don't need to do that. Just contemplate on the fact that it's a manifestation. There are causes that are causing this. That's it. The moment you contemplate on that, that's it. It is extinguished. Remember, these entities are created in the mind because the mind believes there are entities. That's why. When the mind shifts its view from an entity-based one to a manifestation, that is through the lens of anicca, then at that point, these entities cease to exist. That's why you create the world that you believe. You think and you are. That's it. I know I'm simplifying the whole Dharma Skanda into a few words, but ultimately, that is the essence of it. You think and you are. Right, let's conclude for today. We have some merits to go and earn for ourselves. Okay then. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swaminivas to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to practice the path, and engaging in various meritorious deeds. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha, and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha, present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer this message to all monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to our teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks and anagarikas and anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks and sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer this message to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone, from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill the sum of the Sasana. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our names, our loved ones, our forefathers and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those friends and foe who have lost their lives in the wars. Let us transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends to us, acquaintances to us, reminding ourselves of the sacrifices they may have made on our behalf. Out of gratitude and gratefulness, let us take a moment to transfer all the merits we have acquired today to all of them. May, by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may, by the power of all the merits and blessings we have earned throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahataranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you now.
Raga ginnen midatnva, dvesha ginnen midatnva, moha ginnen midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, Sukhita Paravetnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Paravetnva Mamada Siyalu Loka Siyalu Satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita Taravetnva Raga Gini Niveva Dvesha Gini Niveva Moha Gini Niveva Nivan Sapalabeva Nivan Sapalabeva Nivan Sapalabeva
Tunruvange Susi Ananta Mahaguna Belen Silu Loka Silu Satyoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukhita Taravetva Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu